Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I'm very excited to bring our guest to you today. He's a wonderfully engaging director and writer who wrote Kiss Me Quick Before I Shoot, Guy Magar, and I am so thrilled to bring you his story. He immigrated from Egypt at 8 years old, became a film director, and married the love of his life, which is truly an incredible love story. This is a memoir, and you will be engaged from beginning to end in reading this book. Guy, welcome to Unlimited Realities. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Lisa. It's my pleasure.
Well, I have been so excited looking forward to this show, and I absolutely loved your book. And I want to start a little bit, let's start from the beginning, because you have really lived an exciting life. And the fact that you have also lived in Hollywood and been married to the same wonderful, beautiful soul for 27 years is, in fact, a miracle in itself. But let's begin with your immigration to the United States at 8 years old from Egypt. So you have two pretty dynamic parents, from what I can gather in reading your book.
Yes, I do.
They must be really extraordinary people, because just from the essence of what you conveyed in the writing, as well as both the devotion and love that your mother showed you. You open the story, you open the book up with having measles at 8 years old and listening to the airstrikes in Egypt.
Correct.
So let's talk a little bit about how that had to have shaped you as an individual, because you're such an optimist and you're such an authentic heart. I mean, you've got such soul and spirit, which I absolutely loved in reading throughout this entire book. But let's talk a little bit about how it all started, because here you're in a place where, you know, it's easy to have pessimism and negativity and fear and anxiety and all these things, and yet you immigrated with your family at 8 years old to the United States. And let's talk a little bit about how that shaped you.
Okay. First of all, back in those days, in the 30s, 40s, and whatever, Egypt and the Middle East was a very friendly place for people to live. And, you know, we had a home in Alexandria on the beach, and it was an extremely friendly country. And, you know, my dad ran a factory, and it was a wonderful life. I mean, you know, Lebanon in those days used to be a very upcoming country, and they had beautiful hotels on the beach, and the entire Middle East was very different than what it is today. And I was born in 1948, same as the State of Israel was sort of born from the United Nations. And from that day on, as you know, war broke out, and all the Arab countries went to war against Israel on that day. Well, that changed everything, because Israel won that war, and at the time there was a king who was running Egypt named King Farouk, and eventually, because he lost that war, he was overthrown by a general called Nasser. And what Nasser did, he got very unfriendly with non-Arabs, and he started taking over the country as far as all the businesses. He wanted to socialize Egypt. And it was in that world that I grew up in, the world of fear, so to speak, because you never knew when they were going to come, and you never knew when the businesses were no longer going to be yours. And eventually they did come and took over my dad's factory, and they don't pay you for taking it over. And it was an exodus out of Egypt that I was in the middle of when I was 8 years old. And unfortunately, the learned class left, because they were mostly, you know, Europeans and non-Arabs, and doctors, engineers, teachers, they all left Egypt. And there was a great exodus out of Egypt, and I don't think Egypt ever recovered from that, including today. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about it is that I came from a place that was, you know, just a few years after World War II, just a few years after the discovery of a Holocaust. It was a crazy time, I remember, and having a lot of perseverance as immigrants and refugees, you know, really helped me out in the end when I came to the United States and you know, tried to develop the life that I wanted and follow my dreams and come to Hollywood. And maybe that's what it takes to make it in Hollywood.
Well, I tell you, you know, it was really inspiring to me because your parents were young. They were still in their 20s to have such an incredible, you know, just soul and spirit to get out of there with your, you had a sister as well. So they had two children in their 20s. I mean, that shows a lot of spunk. That's chutzpah.
Even more spunk when you find out that no one was allowed to take any money out. So you could leave Egypt. They took away your passport when you left, but you couldn't take any money out. I think you were allowed one piece of jewelry per person. So it wasn't only that they were getting thrown out. They weren't sure where they were going. We had, you know, I have a very large family on both sides, and people were spreading out all over the world. Some went to Brazil, some went to England, some went to Israel, some to Canada. And in a way, I'm really lucky that my parents wanted to come to America, which at the time was, you know, the land of milk and honey after World War II, the place of a future of a world. And I will forever be grateful to my parents for bringing me here.
Yeah, it's and you definitely embraced everything that we have to offer, which again is a testament to how incredible your parents must have been to really guide and direct you in such an incredible way. You know, you wrote in the book how they were kind of like gearing you more towards engineering and maybe even medicine, and you didn't want to go to school that long to start earning money, and
right.
really only found your zest and your passion for film in your 20s after having like lived through you know, the Woodstock period and the good party years and all good fun.
Oh yeah, I was a card-carrying member.
Those were great stories. I chuckled out loud for those. Now when you went, you were actually received at the London Film School. And
right.
that was where you really found your passion for film, even though you had recognition in high school by doing a short film
right.
that really was cutting edge at that time. You still hadn't found your passion at that point. That was interesting to me.
Yeah, you know, I making movies and going to Hollywood is kind of a dream, and a lot of people have it. And, you know, a lot of people give up on it. It seems to be such a faraway dream and such a fantasy that very few people, I think, even though it's overcrowded as it is, but very few people actually get to follow that dream. So I didn't really have that dream. I went to Rutgers in New Jersey for college as an engineering major, and they didn't even have a film school there. They didn't even have a film department. So even though I had made that high school film and I got the bug a little bit, I hadn't thought seriously about following that kind of path. And a lot of people ask me, you know, should they go to film school? And my answer is always yes. And it's not just yes because they have equipment and they have great teachers, but it's to find out if you love it. And I think the only way you can find out if you love filmmaking is to go to film school and start making some films and see if you enjoy the process. It's a difficult, long process, even to make a one-minute film. So
mm-hmm.
what you've got to do is fall in love with a process and be willing to, you know, go on a journey that has small percentage of success and is fraught with rejection and, you know, tremendous amount of people wanting to get in at any level, whether you want to act or be a writer or a producer or a director. There's so many people who want, you know, to get into Hollywood and be part of the industry, that you better be in love with it, because it's going to be one heck of a roller coaster ride.
Right. As you testified in your book, it was quite. Now there was an aspect of the book that I literally laughed out loud and totally knew we were kindred spirits at this point. And it was the point where you were ready to make a film to kind of like use it as your introduction to get more work. And at the time, you had like $850 in your account, and it was like $500 a day to rent a camera.
Right.
And you planned on waiting and waiting for a long weekend and going in on a Friday and telling them, look, I can't bring it in till the end of the day, and knowing that they'd say, oh, don't worry about it, bring it in Tuesday, and therefore you got your film made. And I
Bingo.
Laughed out loud. I thought, oh, you are my brother. Because
you got to do what you got to do,
myself,
you know.
I myself have done the same, similar things in the past on the same kind of mindset. And I absolutely love that story. So let's talk a little bit about, now you've got your film degree. You've gone through film school and you're out in Hollywood.
Right.
And you are trying to break into the industry. And, you know, I deal with intuition in my work, and I found that you innately use your instincts and your intuition throughout the whole book. I can see how you've trusted your feelings in making decisions. And one of them, which I loved also, was when you went in to Universal and sold yourself. You locked the door behind you and sat and stood there and did your 30-second spiel on I need some support and help.
Oh, that was quite a day.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because that's a great story.
Okay. You know, one of the ways that you break in as a director in this town is you got to have a short. You got to have something to show. You just can't walk around saying, I want to be a director, I want to be a director, please hire me, unless you can prove it, unless you can show something. So the other great thing about film school is that you get to make a film that you hopefully will open doors to the industry. And when I came out of the American Film Institute, it was a 25-minute action piece. You know, I start showing it around, and that's all you can do. Just try and show it to as many people as you can and hope you get lucky. And one of the people that saw it was an executive at Universal, and he really liked it. And he thought, you know, it was great, and he even said he was the best student film he had ever seen at the time. And you know, I kept showing it around, and I wasn't getting anywhere, and no one was really coming out and taking a chance on me. And, you know, one day I woke up, and I found out I had only $17 left, literally, in my bank account. And I just got in my car, went to Universal. In those days, security was a lot slacker than it is today. I found my way through the security folks downstairs and made my way all the way up to the penthouse of what's known as the Black Tower at Universal. Famous because that's where a guy named Lou Wasserman had his offices, and he was one of the gods of Hollywood at the time. And, you know, I went to see this executive, and, you know, I didn't have an appointment. It was kind of a daring thing to do, but I was desperate. And I walked past his secretary, who almost had a heart attack, and went into his room, locked the door, because I knew she was going to come in and try and get me out of there. And he was on the phone. He was very surprised to see me. And, you know, he hung up the phone and very angrily asked me what was I doing. I mean, you know, I didn't look dangerous, but it's still a weird thing to just walk into someone's office. And, you know, like you said, in 30 seconds, I just asked for half a minute to talk. And I told him that I was desperate. And if he really meant what he said about my film, and he thought I had some kind of potential to make it in this business, then I needed his help because I wasn't hitting any lucky doors. And, you know, it was kind of one of those moments you never forget in life because, you know, she was banging on the door, the secretary by then, and yelling that security was on its way. And it was one of those moments where you hope things go your way. And they did. He looked at me. He saw how committed I was. He saw how, you know, I was willing to do whatever it took to get into this business. I was asking him for help. He saw a film 3 months earlier that he really thought had promise, and he said okay. And basically he got me a 7-year deal, which was known as the Steven Spielberg deal at the time. They gave it to young directors with promise, and I began working on their 7-year deal at Universal Studios, and I was the happiest young man on the planet when that happened.
Oh, I bet. That's a fork in the road turning point right there.
Absolutely.
That's incredible. I love those stories.
And you know, you got to kind of make your luck a little bit. You know, a lot of people talk about luck and, you know, good luck and bad luck. And sometimes you got to kind of find a way to make some luck happen when there's none coming at you, if you know what I mean.
That is a gem of wisdom right there. That is so true. Because,
yeah,
you know, if we don't take initiative in our life, then we're kind of like that rudderless ship, you know, and there's
I agree.
You know, you have to believe in yourself, which you did, which went on to you being the director of both Battlestar Galactica and the popular television series A-Team.
Oh,
and
yes.
Also having the unknown at that point, James Cameron, come in as your assistant for a short period of time. That was, what a hoot that is.
That was one of those amazing meetings, and it happened on a picture called Shriek that I was going to direct. It was going to be my first feature, and I needed a really wonderful young designer who could design. It was a creature movie, a horror movie, and I was looking around for, to be honest with you, the least expensive designer I could find, because we had very little money to make the movie, and I heard about this guy named James Cameron, who was working in town for Roger Corman, who used to be the guy who made a lot of movies very cheaply and very well known in the industry. And I went to visit Jim, and he showed me his short. And again, you got to have a short to get hired. And I really liked his short. By the way, it looked like it had the elements of that final scene in Avatar. And when Jim says that it took 25 years for special effects to catch up to his ideas in order to make Avatar, he was right, because 25 years ago I saw a little film that had the gem of what an Avatar was going to be.
Wow.
But I hired him, and he designed for me the creature, and in the book there's drawings and paintings of his designs. And he had to leave Roger Corman to come work for me, and at the last second, when Roger found out that James was leaving to become my production visual head of department, and the creature was already built, by the way. We had even built a box, because we were going to shoot in New Orleans and ship it there. And Roger Corman wouldn't let him go, because Roger Corman was a great finder of talent. He's the guy who found, you know, Martin Scorsese and Francis Coppola and Jack Nicholson and Ron Howard. And he knew that Jim was very talented and wasn't going to let him go. So he told him that if he stayed and continued to work for him, he'd give him his first movie after a year. So James came to me and said, I'm really sorry. He was pursuing a directing career. Roger was dangling a wonderful carrot, which,
right,
by the way, a year later he came through and gave him his first movie, which most people don't know was the sequel to Piranha, which was a very cheap movie about piranhas. And that was my story about how James and I kind of got together early in our careers, and then he went on his way, and who knew he was going to become one of the greatest in history.
Wow, that's a great, you have great stories throughout the book. It was an enjoyable book. It was really, and heartfelt. So we're going to get into the more poignant part of the book, which focuses around such a wonderful story about your love affair with the love of your life, Jackie. And you met her, you were 34 years old and really not looking to settle down at the time, having quite a good time, I am sure.
I have to admit it.
I imagine you had you know, life pretty well sewn up as far as a single man in Hollywood. But you met Jackie, and, you know, it sounds like in the story that you knew immediately that this was something special. It wasn't like someone who you were just intrigued by, but you felt triggered. Is that right?
Very true. And, again, I think that falling in love has a lot of luck aspects to it. You know, are you going to run into that one person, that soulmate on this planet that's just right for you? I hadn't for 34 years, and I wasn't really looking. And, you know, a lot of people are married by the time they're 30, but it was never a big thing for me to do that. And I was pursuing filmmaking. I had just come out of the American Film Institute. And, you know, I was dating a lot. There's a lot of wonderful actresses in this town, and you get to meet them when you're in the business. And, you know, social life is high here in Hollywood as far as, you know, going out and meeting people and great clubs and things like that. So when she came, it was completely out of the blue, and it was on a random Saturday night. And, you know, I got very, very lucky, and that's really all I can say about it, because it was one of those things that just quickly developed, and it became apparent to me that this was it. And, you know, some people always ask me, because I give seminars about filmmaking, so people always ask me about this as well. How do you know when you should get married to someone? And my answer is always the same: when you know you'd be the stupidest person in the world not to. And that's
that
when
answer.
You know.
That's right. I love that answer. I think that's, you know, you have such incredible gems of wisdom. And what I love about it is that it's the simplicity of common sense and wisdom. And I rule my life like that, because I think that, you know, if you can just bring it right down and, you know, cut out all the garbage and really bring it down to that point. Well, you know, you were very lucky. She was very lucky. It's a
Thank
very
you.
Blessed. You're welcome.
You're very
it's
kind.
A very,
Thank you.
It's a very it really is. It's a blessed union, and it, you can just feel, as a single woman myself, I was inspired by your love story. So,
well, thank you. Thank you. That's
you're
great.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And, you know, she's her, you really express her essence beautifully in the book. You express her kind heart, her generosity,
right.
her gentleness, her unconditionalism. I mean, it was such a beautiful testimony in regard to who she is, both as a woman and an individual, and also as a partner for life. And
absolutely, and I think, like I said in the book, I think a kind heart is key to falling in love with someone, you know, and loving them eventually more than you love yourself, and that's really being in love.
Well, your unconditionalism, you know, you hear so much about unconditional love, and you know, I get kind of like, you know, nauseated sometimes by some of the catchphrases that you hear around,
right?
Because you know, unconditional love, yes, very difficult to, very very wonderful to assume that you can do that. Very difficult for the average individual to do it. However, you expressed it, showed it, and did this with Jackie, and you lived, what, 23 years with just having a happy-go-lucky kind of life and existence before, was it 23 years, or how long were you married before her diagnosis?
It was actually 26 years.
Okay.
And it was 26 amazing years. Jackie works in retail. She's a very busy woman, 6 days a week in women's fashion, and, you know, obviously filmmaking is almost a seven-day-a-week passion. So we were very busy people, decided, you know, that we would pass on the children thing. It was a mutual agreement that, you know, some people are dying to have children and some people not, and we were just the not side. And
right.
We just really enjoyed our work and our careers, and that's what we focused on. And then out of the blue, on a Monday night, we got that phone call.
And the phone call that changed your entire world, which had to have been both paralyzing and shock-filled, because here she is, she's appearing as a very healthy woman. And she had some symptoms, though, like exhaustion and bruising. Is that right?
Correct. And she was always in great health. You know, she was not someone who even got the flu in the winter. 53 years old, always in great shape because she worked in retail, always looked good in latest fashion and styling. And she was just the last person that you would think of that would get a major illness. And because she was getting more and more tired and exhausted, and she was getting bruises that were not going away. You know, we all get little bruises every now and then when we hit
right.
something on our walking around or whatever. And but her bruises would come and not go away. So, like, weeks later, they'd still be there, and they kept growing. And we thought that maybe she needed some iron, you know? I mean,
right.
that she was anemic in some way. So, you know, we reached a point where we decided to go have a blood test and, you know, find out if she needed some nutrients of some kind, because she was feeling just fine otherwise. And that's the crazy thing about cancer, you know, it kind of comes and hits you when you are absolutely not looking, and it's pretty devastating.
Oh, yeah, it's life-changing, and you, it was a leukemia
correct.
That she had, and when the doctors were, you know, preparing you for the news, the doctor also assured you that it was a curable leukemia, right?
It was curable. However, he did explain that it had a major complication. 90%
right.
of leukemias can be treated with chemotherapy. You do a couple of treatments of chemotherapy, and usually that works. You might have, you know, a relapse 5 or 6 years later and do some more chemo. But most leukemias can be controlled with chemotherapy treatments. Jackie's could not. She had certain complications which made it very difficult to just heal with chemo. So in her particular case, she needed a transplant. And when you have leukemia, in case people don't know, leukemia is basically a blood cancer. And blood is manufactured by bone marrow. So basically leukemia is having bad bone marrow. And when you do a transplant, you got to get rid of a bone marrow that you got because it's diseased, and then you got to have a transplant from someone else's bone marrow. And that's what she needed, was a bone marrow transplant.
Wow. And that's, you know, she's an incredible survivor as well.
She is.
How you explained what she really went through, and the exhaustion and the weight loss, and I understand. It's something that, you know, until you go through it, there's not a lot, you know, as a person that you can really explain, both on the emotional level and in addition to the physical level of seeing your body change as you're going through this.
Yeah, it's devastating.
Very, very much so. Especially, you know, she's a beautiful, beautiful woman, and you know, you've got this whole journey that the two of you went through, as that just really stops the reader in their tracks to appreciate not only their good health, but to really honor their values and who they are. Because it's one thing to be a caretaker; it's another thing to be as unconditional as you were. As a husband, as a partner, as her best friend, and really put everything else on hold so that you could be her 100% caretaker. Because, you know, as you know, life continues. You still have to pay the bills. You still have to keep the electric on. You still have to, you know, do these things that are mundane in addition to being emotionally wrecked with the emotions that you're going through, that your loved one is suffering. So,
that's very, very true. And what you just said is a gem of the reality of, you know, when your loved one becomes ill, you've got to step up to the plate. And being a caregiver is huge, you know, because it's all on your shoulders. And you really want it to be on your shoulder because you just want the patient to focus on healing and what they're going through. And like you said, it becomes a real journey. And I did put aside my entire career and focused on, you know, healing Jackie. And, you know, I just want to mention real quick, one of the problems of transplant is you got to find a match, and that's true for any kind of transplant. Because of immunology, everybody's blood is different, and we all protect ourselves from outside germs. And when you put somebody's anything, kidney, liver, heart, inside somebody's body, there's an immune war that happens, and you better win that war or else it leads to a lot of trouble. And the first thing that happens, in case people want to know about leukemia, is they test your siblings, because siblings have a 25% chance of matching. And when I say matching, I'm talking about 10 numbers. They're called HLAs. And Jackie has a sister, and she, of course, did not match. And that was the first bit of bad news. The second was, there's 11 million people registered around the world for transplant volunteers, and they put your numbers through the computer and to find out where are all the matches. And just so you know how hard it is to match, out of 11 million, Jackie didn't find one perfect match. We found a 9 out of 10, but we did not find a 10 out of 10. And when you get into all that world, the transplant world, and finding the right match, in this case, bone marrow match, it's fascinating in its own way, but it's in another way, when you're deeply involved in it, it can be overwhelming to find out that, you know, your particular HLA numbers aren't matching of 11 million people who are volunteers.
You know, it's one of those things where you think you have problems till you hear about someone struggling with just waiting to hear about a perfect match. I mean, it
Very
really
true.
Puts life in perspective, doesn't it? I mean,
it really does.
It's like everything's on hold just to find out if you've got this perfect match for your loved one. And let's talk a little bit, because you were really blessed again in regard to getting her into the City of Hope, which really was a real catalyst for her healing and finding this remarkable doctor, but also that you were put into a trial study using stem cell research, because at the time, and even now, it's still something that, even though Obama has passed it, it's still something that's not widely done in America like it is overseas and in Europe. So it was an actual trial that she went through. Is that right?
Yeah, what happened was when we couldn't find the match, it became... When you can't find a match, then they decide to do the second best thing. And the second best thing is to find the closest match. And the closest match was, like I said, 9 out of 10. And the problem of 9 out of 10 is now you're heading towards trouble because you're not having a perfect match and you're going to have immune wars inside your body, and some of them can be pretty drastic. That's the first part. The second part is, they used to do, and they still do, what's known as massive chemo. And they do that before they even do the transplant to kill your bone marrow completely. And Jackie had a hard time with her first chemo treatment. So doing massive chemo didn't sound like a great idea to us. So sometimes when things like this happen and you don't have a quick solution or the right solution, or you don't feel good about the treatment, then you've got to go find your treatment. And there is no place in the United States where you can go ask. You have to do the research yourself. And
right.
Thank God for the Internet these days, that is so amazing and everything is on there for us to find. But I went on a weeks-long search that was, you know, pretty obsessive in trying to find out, well, what do we do, because we don't want to do what they're telling us to do. We don't like this treatment that they want us to go through. And we finally found a clinical trial. And clinical trials are very hard to find because they have to be very specific to your condition. And you have to go where they're given because it's not at every hospital in the country. And
right.
The two, there was only two at the time, and one was in Minnesota and one was in Seattle at you know, research cancer centers. And they were the first ones that allowed people over 50 to be in them. And Jackie was, you know, 54 at the time. So all of those things come into play, and we, you know, we talked to those people on the phone. We were getting ready to go there, and then all of a sudden we discovered that pretty close to Los Angeles, about a half hour from here, is City of Hope. And we had heard about it, but we didn't really know a lot about it. And when we started finding out, it turned out to be one of the greatest cancer centers, you know, on the planet Earth. I mean, these guys are amazing. And, you know, we got very lucky meeting the head of oncology there, who turned out to be this gifted doctor that's very well known all over the world, by the way, for what he does. And he took us on. I mean, he took Jackie under his wing. He agreed that we should be in a clinical trial, that she and the clinical trial was a low chemo treatment instead of super high, which was great. And it also involved stem cells from umbilical cords. Now, most umbilical cords are discarded after birth in most hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
But about 20 years ago, they started freezing them because of the knowledge that stem cells was the future of medicine. And the stem cells you're talking about are more the embryonic stem cells in embryos, which are really, really pure and the best, actually, that you can get. But these were stem cell from cord blood. These were not embryonic. So they were not as no one really has a problem with those because, you know, they're usually discarded from umbilical cords. So basically, the nice thing about that, stem cells, is they're baby cells. They haven't grown yet into specialty cells like bone marrow. And so they don't have 10 numbers. They have 6. So it's much easier to find a match for 6 numbers than it is for a 10 out of 10. And amazingly enough, they found a 6 out of 6, but you need 2 of them because there's very little blood inside, obviously, a umbilical cord after birth. So they need 2 of them. To have enough stem cells to make it work. And one came from a boy in Pittsburgh, and another one came from a girl in Spain. And, you know, these are frozen within a half hour after birth, and 8 years later it was that they matched Jackie, and they were brought by plane in ice chests to the City of Hope and transplanted into her very easily, by the way, just through an IV tube. So
wow.
When you do a bone marrow transplant, there's no operation.
Okay. So she was very blessed to have the stem cells from the little girl in Spain predominate, right?
Yeah, what happens is there's an immunity war now between Jackie's cells, the girl's cells, and the boy's cells. So now you really have a three-way war. I mean, it's a little bit very sci-fi. And what happens is survival of the fittest, and that's what you want. You want the strongest one to survive and kind of kill the other two. And hers was the strongest because a few weeks later they did a blood test and found out that Jackie's entire blood had been changed, and she was no longer her own blood type. Her blood type became the same blood type as the girl. And apparently hers was a stronger immune levels than the boys, because it also killed the boys. And that's what you want. You want the strongest possible immune system for the rest of your life in your bone marrow. By the way, we all develop during our lives, all of us, cancer every now and then. It happens all the time. But because of our immunities and having healthy bodies, we never know it. And you know, our white cells kill the new cancer cells that grow. So most people don't know that, but we are protected most of the time by our white cells.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's, you know, it's amazing to hear that her entire blood switched over to that of the girls, because wasn't she was like B positive and she went
correct
to O positive or something?
O negative she went to.
O negative.
And it's amazing because not only that, but obviously gender doesn't matter because she had a boy's blood as well. So gender doesn't matter when it comes to blood. And on top of that, once it works, you now have baby blood, because remember that blood was only 30 minutes old before they froze it. So now you need to be vaccinated a year later, just like babies get vaccinated for polio and all that stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
That's amazing. Oh, my goodness. So she's like, she's ready to go.
She's ready to rock and roll for another 80 years.
Yeah, she's ready to have some fun.
Right.
That's an amazing story. I had no idea that's how stem cells actually reproduce.
Yeah, well, the great thing about stem cells is all cells begin as stem cells. And then the idea now is to be able to control them so that they grow into a particular type. For example, if you have heart disease, they would like to find a way to take those stem cells and turn them inside your body into heart cells. That way your heart can become healed. Same with kidneys, same with liver, same with anything. And, you know, they're hoping eventually to do that with nerve cells. For a lot of people who come back from war is paralyzed, for example, and be able to grow new nerve cells and heal people. Stem cells is the future of medicine. There is no question about it. Whether they're going to be embryonic or where they get them from is another story, and we can, you know, argue about that all day long. But in my book, there is absolutely no question that the future of medical healing is the discovery of stem cells and manipulating them to the kind that you need to heal.
It's absolutely, you know, breathtaking and edge cutting. I mean, we're
totally
on. It's amazing. It truly is amazing. And the thought that our government suppressed this information for as long as we we have is mind boggling to me.
It is mind boggling, and it's a great shame because, like you said, during the Bush years, especially, most of our scientists were going to Europe to work on the stem cells development because they couldn't do it in the United States, which was, you know, really a shame. And by the way, within a couple of days of Obama taking office, he turned all that around, thank God. And now, you know, the medical folks have full access to stem cells, and they're already starting to do some amazing things that we're going to see in years to come. I mean, in Jackie's case, literally, the stem cells went into her blood system, and you wait. You wait until they discover, they being the stem cells. I mean, it's called a medical miracle.
Yeah.
The stem cells travel around the body. They look around for what is wrong, where are they needed, and they discover there's no bone marrow because the bone marrow was you know, taken out of chemo beforehand. It was emptied of bone marrow, and they go, oh, wow, there's no bone marrow. This person needs bone marrow. Let's turn into bone marrow. And they turn into bone marrow and start doing what bone marrow cells does, which is to make and manufacture blood. And that process took about 17 days.
It just absolutely phenomenal. I mean, that is just, it blows my mind that this
It blew mine.
I bet, because it's like, you know, life right before you. It's like, here we go. We can,
and,
you know, it's...
And you know, the second it happened, the day it happened, that Jackie knew she had grafted, it's called grafting, and that she had new bone marrow that was, you know, working 24 hours a day, like all of our bone marrow, making blood cells. That was it. I mean, we left the hospital a few days later, and that was the end of our cancer journey. I mean, obviously, it took a whole year for her to build up her strength and gain her weight and get herself together again. But basically, once those stem cells turned into bone marrow and were manufacturing blood, she was healed.
Amen. I mean, that is just what an incredible story. And you know, you're so humble, because I am certain that a large part of her being able to heal as well as she did was because of the love and support that you were able to provide her. And that's not something that I want to just kind of fluff off, because there's so many people out there who are suffering from chronic illness or disease or cancer, and they have loved ones around them who love them as much as they're capable of loving. However, not everyone is capable of being unconditional to the degree that you were in caretaking. And I find that as such a phenomenal, just an awe-inspiring, personal, heartfelt connection for me to you, because that's just to me explains who you are as your soul, of what an incredible being you are. And let's talk a little bit about caretaking, because it's obviously all-encompassing, and you have taken on her journey as your own, and you also did, you know, got on the computer and did your own little research, and you came up with, you know, all these ideas and support, and you also have a wonderful bit of wisdom that you provide for caretakers. And it's basically, can you talk a little bit, can you tell our audience what that belief is? Because you advise other caretakers on how to make peace with the why.
Yes, we do. And thank you for your kind words, by the way. And Jackie would second what you said, because Jackie always does tell me that being there for her and doing all the research and finding out everything that we needed to know was obviously paramount to her healing. And, you know, I can refer back to, you know, those wonderful words we all hear when we get married, in sickness and in health.
Right.
And, you know, we had an amazing, you know, 27 years before her sickness. And once her sickness happened, that union doesn't weaken. That union doesn't go away. That partnership is cooking with gas, so to speak. So all I did was transition from, you know, whatever I was doing work-wise to just walking away from all that and just focusing on a whole new task, which I knew nothing about, and I needed to educate myself on, and took a lot of meetings, by the way, with a lot of doctors, got a lot of people on the phone. One of the things I'm grateful about is the cancer community is very open to sharing information. You can get top guys and women doctors all over the country and speak to them, which I was very grateful to discover, by the way. But, you know, what you're actually doing is changing your focus. And instead of, you know, developing screenplays and dealing with financing of my next picture, it became, I need to heal Jackie, whatever it takes. And that's what it becomes. And, you know, as a caregiver, it takes a lot more than just being there, because, you know, your mind is a lot clearer than the patient, in the sense that the emotional toll is really on the patient. They're the ones who are ill. They're the ones who are at risk. So you really need to take over as far as the thinking process even. And, you know, what is the correct way to go? What is the better way to go? Do we like this treatment? Do we like that treatment? And if we don't know anything about that, let's go to UCLA and talk to their top oncologists. And if we don't like what they say, let's go to USC and talk to their guys. And that's what it was. It was an education because I had never heard of stem cells before all this happened. So I didn't even know anything about it, never mind finding a clinical trial. So, you know, becoming a caregiver, it means you become a partner. You're the same partner in marriage that you were before. But now, you know, the duties have changed. You know, like you said, I'm the guy who still has to go pay the bills and take care of a dog and keep everything moving. And you know, Jackie's loved by so many people. There was a tremendous amount of phone work that needed to be done every few days to bring people. People wanted to know how she was doing and would call in. And, you know, and then being at the hospital care all day long, you know, make sure that her bed was made whenever she went, you know, to take a shower and make sure that, you know, the food orders are correct and make sure that the nurses are giving her the correct medicine. I mean, I slept there, you know, in a cot right next to her for many months in the hospitals in order to make sure that that kind of care happens. And I think that's all part of being a partner. I think you have to roll up your sleeves and take care of your partner. And your partner is doing the big battle. You know, they're going through the actual journey of the medical process, and you want them to, number one, you want them to feel completely secured, completely surrounded by love and optimism that whatever is going on is going to work. And you know, it's up to us to, you know, keep mentally alert and find joys in opening up, you know, the curtains in the morning and pointing out a great sunrise. And, you know, making sure that that day can go as easily and as well as it possibly can, even though there might be some problems during the day and, you know, whatever comes up needs to be, you know, handled. And I think it's part of being a caregiver. And I reach out to all the caregivers out there because it's not an easy job. And I think that everyone out there who is a caregiver to someone they love, I tip my hat to them because, you know, it's a tough job, and you got to focus on making that happen 24/7 and keeping everything else going on the side as far as your life and your home and children and pets and all the rest of it.
Right, but you definitely are a cut above the most because I tell you, I'm just amazed at your dedication and your devotion and the selflessness that you. You know, it is a rarity, and it's not something that everyone can do. And even though they should, no doubt, and even though you make those vows till death do us part in sickness and in health, you should. But it's not easy for some people, and you really did it with, you know, kind of like, you know, not even a thought to yourself. It was like, okay, well, this is the battle we have to deal with, and we're going to look at this as, okay, this course of action, and this is where we're going to put our focus. And it was just an amazing, inspiring story for me to read with someone who had such unconditional love, such devotion, such compassion, such empathy. And, I mean, even these little nuances that you did, like you just said, making sure her bed was taken care of while she's taking a shower. I mean, these just tell me just what an incredible soul you are to think of such details in regard to the other person. I mean, it really, you step completely outside of yourself and put yourself in her shoes in such an empathetic way that it's beyond precious. It really is.
Well, thanks, Lisa. I'm very grateful that you enjoyed the journey. By the way, that's why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I wanted to share with people this medical journey that we went on. You know, the book is a lot about filmmaking and talks about a lot of my film stories, which are a lot of fun, like almost decapitating a Drew Barrymore when she was 8 years old. And I found out my first producer was a mafia hitman. I mean, you know, I've been through some crazy stuff in the movie world. But really, I wrote the memoir right as Jackie was healing. I started writing it because I wanted to convey and share this journey of, you know, what happens when cancer hits your family. How do you handle it? How do you deal with it? And, you know, it was really great for me to be able to put in words because now somebody like yourself can read it and appreciate it. And that's what I was hoping for. I was hoping that people would enjoy the memoir. And if anything else, you know, I'm hoping that the memoir will sell in every gift store, at every hospital in the country. And when people are ill, that this book can help them, you know, sometimes with a chuckle, get through the day.
Well, and it was, you know, that's what was so incredible in the memoirs, because not only did you explain your film career and all these wonderful stories, but you combined it with real life, you know, trials. And the most difficult one being someone you loved, you know, struck with having to deal with overcoming cancer. And, you know, it's a wonderful book for anyone both interested in, you know, movie business, but also as a caregiver, also as someone who has overcome illness or really just wants to read a great memoir. And you have a statement in your book from Kiss Me Quick Before I Shoot, and it's in regard to as a caregiver. I'm just going to read it. And you wrote, "As a caregiver, I can advise other caregivers that they must make peace with the why, however difficult it might be. You have to accept that a body part has gone bad without rhyme or reason." And I think that that is, you know, something that's so incredibly simply put, but so heartfeltly, you know, taken and received, and sometimes difficult to accept, because that's the first question that goes through your mind is, why did this happen? What happened that created this? Was it environmental? Was it that, you know, she didn't eat the right foods? Was it that she was exposed to something? So you go through all these whys in your head, and then it just comes down to, you know what, that's such wasted energy to focus on the why. The fact remains, this is what we're dealing with, and let's take it to the next level.
And,
so,
you know, that was the toughest part in the beginning for me, and I'm really glad you touched on it because, you know, it comes up for everybody, and I was
right.
really hung up on it. I mean, I was trying to figure out what, you know, had happened, what particular incident had happened in the last couple of years that would precipitate such an illness. And when you get a big illness like that, you know, you want to know. I mean, you know, like 4 months earlier, we went swimming with the dolphins in Mexico, and I started wondering, you know, can you get cancer if, you know, you touch a dolphin? I mean, it was that crazy.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And, you know, the bad news about cancer, and I speak about it on my website, the book website, kissmequickbeforeishoot.com, and I speak about that, is that they don't know why we get cancer. They don't know why any cancer comes around. You know, there are people who smoke 2 packs a day and they never get lung cancer, and there's a lot of people with lung cancer who never had a puff in their lives.
Right.
I mean, they just don't know. You know, they have ideas and they have theories, but they just don't know. And especially when it comes to, you know, a blood cancer, because it's so bizarre that, you know, the bone marrow is not healthy. It's not something that, you know, we can affect. So that even becomes weirder, you know, because you just don't understand, well, what happened to the bone marrow. So that's the horror about cancer. And by the way, there's 1.5 million new cases every year in the United States, and it's growing. And
wow.
I don't think that we as a country have dealt with the fact that, in my opinion, this isn't a pandemic, because, you know, people are worried about things like the bird flu coming over here and, you know, having a couple of people or whatever get it. And what we don't understand is that cancer, whatever way it's coming, whatever reason it is, and it's got to be common for 1.5 million people to get it every year.
Right.
In many different ways, from prostate to breast to bone marrow, something is going on, and it's going on very commonly. So I definitely think it's in the air or the food or the water. Something is going on that's bringing on cancers, because even after all this research, after billions of dollars, and after all these years, and as far as we are today than we were 20 years ago, we still don't know why. And that's
right.
The greatest crazy question about the entire process.
And what a blessing that there are stories like yours and Jackie's that can actually inspire people who are diagnosed with cancer and still in shock from that diagnosis to know that there's hope, you know, to know that, hey, it may suck and you may have, you know, you're going to have to go through treatment. You might have a year or more that you're fighting this, or, you know, and I hate saying fighting because then it's like you're battling it, but then, you know.
That's a good word, actually. It is a battle.
It is a battle, you know, and you really, you really get to that point of, you know, you're such an optimistic person, and Jackie sounds like such an optimistic person, and I'm sure that that in itself is a little bit of a seedling of what carried you through. You know, it's, had you been pessimistic, had you been a negative personality, had you been, you know, blaming and angry and all of that, who knows if this would have had such a quick turnaround for you, you know?
What? You know, the same perseverance of trying to make it in the movie business and coming to Los Angeles and not knowing a soul in the business and finding a way to do the things that I wanted to do, which basically was to direct films and television shows. You know, all that energy went into, we got to find the best way to heal Jackie. And
right.
There was no ifs and buts about it, you know, and just like, you know, there was no ifs and buts about becoming a director. I had to find a way to do it, even if it meant breaking into Universal Studios and, you know, locking the door to an executive office to be able to get an answer. You know, when it came to Jackie's illness, there was no ifs or buts. And by the way,
right.
I just want to quickly mention that September is Leukemia Month in the United
oh, wow.
States. And one of the great things that people can do, and which I know many are not aware, is to become a donor. Because
yes.
most of the time you will never get to match, you will never have to give your blood, your bone marrow, but it's very easy to become a donor. You just have a blood test and a swab of your inside your cheek with a cotton swab. So it's really easy to become a donor, and it's one of the greatest things in the world to be able to donate bone marrow and save somebody, as was Jackie's case, for example, but hers was cord blood, remember. But most people do find a match out of 11 million people who are registered in the world. So if you're interested in being a leukemia donor, blood donor, it's really easy to do. Just go to your hospital and they will, you know, do the swab, and it's no big deal. And you will be listed in the registry with your type. And then, you know, the chances are very slim you will ever be called on, and that it's somebody with your numbers will be needy, but this is one of the greatest things that people can do, is to donate their bone marrow.
Oh, thank you for that. What a gift that is as a donor, to be able to save someone's life. I appreciate you bringing that information to the audience. And I also, we have like 3 minutes, so I want to make sure I put your websites. I have them in the chat room here, but I want to say them out loud for our listeners. And it is www.kissmequickbeforeishoot.com, and you can get a hold of Guy there or buy his book. I totally recommend everybody. I think this is one of those eye-opening books that really makes you take stock of your values and your priorities, regardless of your life circumstances. And not only that, it's an incredibly wonderful read. So I really, really appreciated just meeting you and knowing your story and being inspired by you, and you truly are a gift, both you and Jackie. Now, Jackie's also, I want to plug her salad dressings, okay?
Yes.
Because I'm
first of all, I just want to say thank you, Lisa, because your appreciation of a book and what we tried, the story we tried to tell, is made my day, and I'm very, very grateful for your thoughts, and not only that, but having me in as your guest on your radio show, because you really understood what I was trying to do with a book, and that means a lot to me, and I'm very grateful to you. While Jackie was convalescing, she did develop some salad dressings. They're called Jackie's Secrets, and she's been always a great cook, and we started putting that together. The line isn't out yet. I know you had mentioned that you were looking for it, so it's not out yet, but we hope to get it out soon. You just have to. You can't do it if you only have one or two products, by the way, in the line. They need like five or six on the shelf. So she needs to develop more and more flavors.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I will be checking my gourmet shelves here in the grocery store, because I look forward to supporting Jackie on this.
Well, thank you very, very much. And by the way, just so everybody knows, we are giving away two City of Hope portions of the book revenue. So when you buy the book, you're actually donating to the City of Hope.
And the City of Hope is the place that was able to really progress Jackie's treatment and take her to this place of remission. And we just have a short period of time, but you were also diagnosed with prostate cancer, went through surgery, and you're both in remission now. So God bless you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You guys are just such an inspiration, and I really, really appreciate meeting you and knowing your story and getting to talk to you. This has been a real highlight for me as well. And God bless you and Jackie, and thank you, audience, for tuning in and listening. And please buy Guy's book, Kiss Me Quick Before I Shoot. Guy Magar, God bless you all. I'll talk to you all next week. Guy, again,
thank you, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This was wonderful. Have a wonderful day, and give Jackie my love. Thank you
so
much.
I will. She's right next to me, and I'll tell her.
I appreciate it. You guys have a great day. Thank you.
You too. Thank you,
okay.
And to your audience.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.